inch by inch and row by row, gonna make this garden grow. All it takes is a rake and a hoe and a piece of fertile ground. And inch by inch and row by row, someone blessed these seeds I sow. Someone warmed them from below till the rains come and tumble them down.
Welcome to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Green Counties. We are Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas, Master Gardener volunteers. The podcast of Digging In with Master Gardeners is available through this station and via a link on our own website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/gardening.
This is Digging In with Master Gardeners, a production of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Green and Columbia Counties. We are Teresa Golden and Jean Thomas, Master Gardener volunteers, and we have with us today another Master Gardener volunteer, Linda Levitt. We'll be talking about container gardening, and Linda is our local expert.
Linda, tell us a little about yourself and how you became the local expert on container gardening.
Thank you. I have grown up in this part of the country and was an insurance broker for many, many years, always in love with gardening. Moved up here in about 2003 and realized when I moved up here that gardening was going to be a challenge because of the fact that we had many, many deer issues. And I'm sure that you all can relate to that. The deer, no matter what I was putting in the garden, they were eating it. And becoming container gardener expert, I should say, thank you, I was able to move the containers closer to the house. The deer were not able to get to them. I was able to plant things that I would not have been able to plant in the yard. And so that's how I became an expert in that particular area. But now I have learned what does work in the yard, and I can do things in the yard that the deer won't touch. So I have about 30 plus containers in my garden and in my yard.
Well, let's start with definition of container gardening.
First of all, my first thought was that it was movable, that you can change from place to place, year to year, and make, you know, wherever you need it to be done. But then when you think about container gardening, you also think about raised beds, which can also be considered container gardening. So when I talk about container gardening, you're talking about a focus of a pot, a container, a raised bed where you can hold soil and have really good drainage. The one thing you don't want is some type of porous, like a cardboard box, for example, that's going to soak in water and obviously won't hold the soil or the water. So when I talk about container gardening, there's a lot of things you can use as containers. Again, being movable, drainage, holding soil.
So there's both indoor and outdoor container gardenings. Obviously, any houseplant is growing in a container of some sort. So let's go outside and leave houseplants for another show. Will any plant thrive in an outdoor container, or are there some that just won't work?
Well, here in the Northeast, we are able to grow anything in a container if we have the right conditions, meaning light and the type of soil and the watering requirements. Anything can be grown. I've grown tropicals in the summertime. I've also taken those tropicals and I've moved them indoors in a heated, semi-heated garage, and they can overwinter. But one of the things that you want to be careful of is that anything will grow outside with the right conditions.
Okay, so let's look at different types of container gardening then. Is there a common rule that applies? You know, things related to soil, light, water, etc.
Most people don't realize this. When you have a container garden, and I'm talking mostly about pots and raised beds, not so much, but mostly when you have pots, what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to buy the soil. You're going to want to buy potting soil. Soil from your garden is not going to be sufficient. It's not going to have the correct nutrients, because what you have to realize is by gardening in a pot, you're not pulling in nutrients from all through your yard and have more of an expansive space that that the plants can move. I mean, great, pull the nutrients from other parts. So you're going to need potted soil, which is something that people, you can't use your soil. The other thing too is your soil is not contaminated. You don't have to worry about worms. You don't have to worry about insects other than surface insects, which you can see obviously and be able to take care of. Fertilizing usually doesn't happen you don't really need to do it during the summer months because of the fact that it's a short-lived period of time. It's maybe 4 or 5 months. So you really don't need to get into fertilizing. And as far as pest control is concerned, as I mentioned, you're talking about surface bugs. You're not talking about anything that you would find within the soil because you're working with sterilized soil.
Okay, so now let's talk about some drawbacks. I am picturing a nice big pot full of tropical plants sitting in a gorgeous deck. And the subsequent staining of said deck, are there, besides the common sense correction to that, what other things might happen if you don't think ahead with container gardening?
Well, the thing about container gardening, one of the things that you want to do, first of all, when you have a pot that's got drainage through holes in the bottom of the pot, and that might be your plastics, and that is going to obviously stain your deck. It's obviously going to allow the soil to be drawn outside the pot. So what I have done is I've always put a tray underneath and I've put rocks in the bottom of the tray if I have a surface that I certainly don't want to ruin. So the other thing about pots, you have to be careful because the initial cost of containers, if you're looking for some fancy, really nice containers, they can be pretty expensive. So your initial cost might be a little bit more than if you were to throw it in the garden. But after that, you've got your soil that you need to buy. Usually what I do is I remove at least 1/3 of the soil each and every year because the soil from the year before is no longer got the nutrients that you're going to need to have the flowers or the plants to really thrive. So there's a cost there too. So I think container gardening can be a little bit more expensive than if you were to throw something into your garden.
Okay, so it's a cost balance kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. We pretty much covered the situations that make container gardening preferable: space and worms and ground critters and soil quality. Speaking of soil quality, depending on the plants, you would use different types of potting soil?
No, usually the potting soil is one type.
You would just use basic potting?
Yeah, you can get all sorts. There's a lot of different companies. There's the Miracle-Gro one, which has the fertilizer already in it. There are organic potting soil. So there's a number, but each of the soils that you buy are all sterilized and pretty much the same.
So that's reaching the goal of not having all the contaminants.
Correct.
Okay. What makes a good container? We discussed that a little bit, but I mean, I want to take my watering trough and put it up on the deck and plant it with tomatoes. Is that kind of a good thing to do?
What were you going to use? I'm sorry.
A watering trough?
The one thing about using a watering trough, I'm going to skip ahead for a second, and a watering trough is made out of metal. And one of the things that I found by putting plants in a metal pot is you cannot put it in the direct sun without frying the plant.
Oh, there's a thought.
So that is one of the things that I find difficult because I was going to put some big watering troughs in my driveway and realizing that it was the south side of the house and realized how quickly they fry.
So what does make a good container?
Anything that is not porous from the standpoint that you're going to lose water outside. Now, the only thing I'm going to step back for a second and say is that a whiskey barrel, which I find to be terrific, is also very porous. So there is some soaking of the water. But the good news on that is that the soil maintains the moisture a lot longer than some of the other containers. For example, terracotta pots. Terracotta pots need to be watered all the time because, again, it's porous. If you're going to have, what makes a good container? Anything that you're going to have to take care of it depending upon what it is. Again, the metal trough is going to need more water. Your terracotta is going to need more water. But you do need to have, whenever you have a good container, you're going to have to make sure that you've got some kind of drainage. Has to be, because whether you use shards from a pot or you use, some people use Coke bottles, the empty liter Coke bottles, and they put them in the bottom of the container in order to help the drainage. You can put rocks in the bottom. Some people use mulch in the bottom of the container. But you're going to have to make sure that you've got the appropriate drainage for these pots.
Okay, sidebar on that. I'm going to say the dreaded two-syllable word, plastic. Plastic liners in a metal container would maybe alleviate the cooking situation.
It may alleviate, but you still got your heat.
Okay, so. How about terracotta? Terracotta. Can you lose less?
You would probably lose less.
Okay. So in some cases, an insert would maybe
some
help.
Cases, an insert might work.
Okay.
Again, when you do container gardening, one of the things that you have to understand is that it's all an experiment. And sometimes things work better than others.
That's the definition of gardening. Okay, what was the most original choice of a container that you've ever seen that was successful?
A toilet.
Wow, that's different.
Yeah, and you can water it.
You can water it. It's got great drainage.
I like it. Okay. Now, when you're doing a container garden with multiple plants, how do you know what plants are going to work well together?
What you have to really pay attention to is when you purchase plants, what you're going to look for is you're going to look for the tag or the information regarding that plant as to what the watering conditions are, the light conditions are, and it really won't make any sense if you have a plant that needs less water and one that needs more water. That's just not going to work. So you're going to have to make sure you have the same requirements for light and water.
So you can go to the garden center or the plantings downtown and steal their ideas?
Yes, you can.
Okay.
How big a container do you need?
Depends on what you want to put in it. I've got very large, as I mentioned, I've got whiskey barrels. I've got some containers that are probably 3 feet high and 3 feet wide. And again, one of the experiments that you have is people say, well, how many do I know to put in the pot? Again, it's an experiment. I've put in too many things and they just don't work as well. And then you back off and you put less plants in the year after. The larger the pot, the less watering.
Once you've got it saturated initially.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay. That makes sense.
You were listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson and Columbia County and Acre and Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. The topic for this segment is container gardening, and we're joined by Linda Levitt. Let's dig right back in.
Isn't there a rule, since we're talking design now, a thriller, a filler, and a spiller?
I have taken a number of courses in container gardening, and one of the things about the more unique plant containers, you'll find that the thriller, filler, and spiller don't necessarily have to be used. I have done both with, and for those listening, a thriller would mean something that's extremely, probably the tallest plant in the grouping. A filler would be something that's really going to take the space up between the thriller, and then the spiller is something that's going to just work over the sides and just hang down. I've seen containers with a thriller and spillers and no filler. I've seen all sorts, and I've done things myself, which I don't usually follow by those rules anymore. So the newer approach to container gardening is do what you think is beautiful.
But for the newbies who are lacking confidence, that might be a good way to start because it's almost idiot-proof.
That's correct.
Okay. Now, you can do that with ornamentals, of course, but you could play with herbs and veggies as ornamentals also, no?
I, a lot of times, will use variations in flowering plants and vegetables or herbs. I will put them all in the same container, and it works beautifully. You can get really creative by putting the vegetables, and mostly your leafy vegetables like kale and stuff like that, will look really nice in a container, along with the flowering plants for the summer. So
the container gardenings can also be broken into ornamental and useful. The ornamental can range from a mixture of flowering plants in a pot on a patio to a row of formal conifers outside an exclusive restaurant, or even the window boxes on a summer cottage. Can you describe some of your favorite combos for specific circumstances?
All of the combinations you have mentioned I have used over the years. When deciding on a grouping, keep in mind flowering habits all summer or only certain times. So what you're going to make sure you want to do is you've got to look at your pot and you've got to figure out what's going to work best. If you want to have interest all the time, you're going to have to look, again, look at the tags that you get and figure out what your flowering habits are. Or in the case of vegetables, when are they going to be at their prime? Also remember one of the things that a lot of people, at the beginning of the spring, you go into the garden center and you're like, wow, look at all those beautiful flowers. And what people don't realize is that a lot of the interest can be in your foliage. One of the plants that I use all the time are coleus. Coleus, they have the most beautiful variations in their leaves, whether they be ruffled, whether they be variegated, they're absolutely quite gorgeous. And so one of the things you want to remember is to look at the foliage in your, as your interest. The other thing too is over the years, I have taken conifers and I've put them in pots. And if the pot is large enough, I have actually overwintered conifers in the pot. But the one thing you cannot do is have the pot can't be too small, because you don't want to have freezing and thawing. So if the freezing and the thawing of the root system happens, the conifer is not going to live. But I've been super successful over the years. If the pot is large enough and the drainage is good, the conifers, and I don't water them, they just are outside all winter long. And one of the things that I think is fabulous is that what I've done is taken that conifer pot. In the spring, I start out with pansies surrounding the conifer. And then in the summer, I'll have maybe some kind of daisies. In the fall, I'll put mums or asters, and it adds the interest. So you've got your thriller is your conifer, and a lot of times it's either a thriller or a filler that goes around the conifer. So you leave yourself enough room around the tree to make sure that you've got enough to plant different flowers, or even in the winter, I've taken greens and winterberry and put it around the conifer. And I've also used gourds and hay in the fall.
Is it true that you can insulate pots in order to minimize that thawing and freezing effect?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was just looking at one of the gardening catalogs, and they sell German blankets that you wrap around the pot and you tie it. And it's supposed to, I just saw this the other day, and you take it and you put it around and tie it to keep it warm.
Are they like styrofoam or something?
No, they're wool blankets. Wool. They're blankets. Yeah, they're blankets from Germany.
Mm-hmm. I've also Salvation heard, Army girls.
That's I also true. Heard you can put a pot inside a pot, and in between you put leaves or twigs or something that will help with the insulation as
or
well.
Or like you can put peat as moss. Much as it's not natural. You can put mulch, or you can put like the styrofoam.
All those peanuts.
The peanuts. Because okay. That will keep it.
Mulch is a great idea, because then you can reuse it in the spring when you break it all up again.
Right. And the other thing too is the plants that I overwinter outside, I do make sure I put lots of mulch in the top of the pot. When you're doing container gardening, you're not necessarily, if you want to keep the moisture in more, you can put mulch on the top. Most of the time I don't. But with the conifers that are going to overwinter, those things are loaded up with mulch in the fall. I will take it and load them up real high with mulch.
Okay, so a raised bed and a window box are both container gardenings. Mm-hmm. But with a raised bed, you can't like refresh the soil year after year, or can you?
Yeah, you can.
So you could take out the top layer, work in some more and turn it, and probably work in some mulch as well. Because usually raised beds, do you more tend to graze veggies?
Right, exactly. Your container gardens are mostly used for vegetables. Yeah. And one of the things that, as I mentioned before, I usually take out 1/3 of the soil. So even in a raised bed, you can
You
can freshen up the soil. In a raised bed, you don't necessarily have to use a sterile soil.
Okay.
Because it's pretty much, a raised bed is pretty much within your garden, as opposed to up against a house or things like that. So.
Okay, now here's a question. I'm going to bring in the snaky worms. If you have a raised bed and you're building a new raised bed, are you better to put in bag topsoil, which is not totally sterile, but a whole lot cleaner than something that you would dig out of your yard?
Well, I would say yes, but your topsoil also needs to be augmented with peat moss and some other nutrients.
So you'd have to make up a mixture.
Yeah, you've got to make up a mixture. Yeah. Topsoil is not good for...
So there's still no easy
fix.
Easy.
No, no.
Okay. I plant bush beans into my perennial beds because they're pretty and mm-hmm. I'd like to nosh all the time. And I put the annual flowers into the veggie garden. Do you do changing up things like that with your containers?
I do.
Okay.
That's the one thing that really got me interested too in containers is I like change. Mm. So I do things. The only thing I will say I'm not good about changing is in our back door, we have containers where I grow all the herbs. So when we're cooking, we just go out the back door, mm-hmm. cut the herbs, and go back in. And they've got the right sunlight, and they do very well there. So I don't change that at all.
Yeah, my basil is outside my kitchen door.
Yeah, yeah. All the herbs are there. One of the things I have overwintered successfully is rosemary. Rosemary, I put in my garage, which stays at about 50 degrees, and I put it in front of a window, and I water it like once a week, and it's done beautifully every year.
Oh,
so rosemary.
That's a good one.
A lot of people have put rosemary in the house, and it's too dry. It's too dry and too warm.
Yeah.
But the rosemary in my garage does beautifully.
Okay, so we've successfully planted and tended our container garden throughout the summer and into the autumn. Now what?
I have on my front porch, I've got three containers, and each season they change. And now we're coming upon the holidays, and I take them and I put cut greens, winterberry, red twig dogwood, ornamental grasses, I will put in those pots, and they will last me all winter long. So those pots are on my front porch all year long. The thing you have to be careful is obviously the soil's going to freeze. So I try to, you know, I'll pour hot water in it just to get so it doesn't ice. The other thing, too, I use it for birch logs. And one year, the biggest container, I actually bought a small Christmas tree and put it in there and decorated it on my front porch.
So are there certain kinds of containers you need to use so that they don't crack and break?
Yes.
Yeah, my terracotta wouldn't handle
terracotta
that well.
Terracotta or any kind of the pottery will not do well outside in the wintertime. But mine are on a covered porch, so they do okay, but they're not neither. They're plastic and wood. So I've had them for years, and that's what I do every single year. Every single season, they have different flowers in them.
Okay, so come spring,
mm-hmm.
do you empty it all out and start over with fresh soil all the way, or you just... get rid of
in those, yes, because of the pine, yeah.
Yeah, oh, okay, and then clean the
I clean them out. You can clean the pots with Clorox and water.
Mm-hmm.
I must confess, I don't do that all the time, especially with whiskey barrels, because whiskey barrels are very difficult to try and wash.
Well, you can't empty a whiskey barrel and refill it, do you?
I'm sorry?
You don't empty a whiskey barrel?
A third.
Okay, a third,
so
yeah.
We were talking before about drawbacks of container gardening. In the beginning of the summer... or the beginning of the end of the spring, when I start to plant everything, I've got to empty all of those things. And sometimes there are left residual plantings in them because the containers that are in the yard, I will cut back the plants but not take out the root system. So now I've got a shovel and I am out there with a shovel digging, which is the roots can go all the way down sometimes into the ground because in a whiskey barrel. And so from a work perspective, it can be a little bit more work.
So these are the big permanent containers.
These are the big permanent ones, yeah.
But as far as the window box size or a couple foot square, you just empty them and clean them in the fall?
No.
Or do you wish
in
you
the spring.
Had done it?
I wish I had done it in the fall.
So you don't actually try to wheel them into a garage or a basement at all and overwinter them there?
No.
Okay.
There's a couple of things. Lately I have been using succulents in some of my pots, like for decorating on top of tabletops and things outside. And the succulents I will bring into that garage. I've built a shelf system in front of one of the windows, and the succulents will stay on the shelf, and they need very little water. And they will last from year to year. So that works really, really well. The rosemary I'll bring in, but for the most part, I might have a tropical that I want to bring in, like a hibiscus or something. And in that case, I will take a dolly and I'll wheel it into the garage.
And the hibiscus is one that you can bottom dress with pansies and things like that when you bring it back out?
I don't usually.
No?
The hibiscus usually stays by itself.
Okay. Yeah.
It's got enough interest.
What did we miss?
I think what I'd like to say is I have had so much fun with container gardening, because one of the things you do is you can change it every year, and the newer plants that are coming into being can take advantage of that. You can change your color schemes. You can, but I must say that with my deer issues, I have the same plantings in all the containers that are out in the yard, and I don't vary that at all.
Oh, that's an interesting point. So you have to be aware of what critters are wandering through and nibbling on your plants.
Correct.
As to where you're going to put
and
them.
And sometimes I blame it on the deer, but it's the rabbits. Yeah. And the chipmunks.
Yeah.
And the woodchucks.
You know what? The woodchucks live across the street, and I had them one year, and haven't had them since.
Well, they eat everything right down.
They eat everything. Yeah. They go through like a lawnmower and eat everything. But the containers out this year, I've experimented. I'm going to see. Mm-hmm. I bought two rose bushes when I was down in Virginia, and I fell in love with these rose bushes, and I put them in huge pots on my deck. Oh. And I'm got them all burlapped up and stuff, so I want to see if they're going to make it. So this is my experiment this year.
Here's another question. Tree mm-hmm. roses.
Yes.
Do you ever grow them?
No.
Okay, because I've seen them for sale mm-hmm. in the nurseries as full trees.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking the pansies in the bottom of those would
look gorgeous.
Awesome. And that would be something that you might potentially be able to wheel into the garage.
Correct.
For the winter.
Correct.
Okay, I've just got my idea for the year.
So that's my experiment for this year. This is new for me. So I'm trying these two rose bushes for see what happens. Huh. But they're outside.
So you'll have to come back and let us know how it worked out.
I will do that, definitely.
So Linda, it's been a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and expertise. We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 FM Radio for hosting this program, as well as the production support from Donna Peterson and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can learn more about Cornell Cooperative Extension by checking out our website at ccecolumbiagreene.org. If there are topics or questions you'd like us to answer on future episodes of this show, email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. And please include radio show in the subject title. You can contact us with any other gardening questions by emailing us at colgremg@cornell.edu as well. Master Gardeners are typically available on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday in the Hudson office, and on Tuesday and Thursday mornings in the ACRA office. We look forward to hearing from you. The topic for this segment is invasive pests. Joining us for this discussion is Tim Kennelty, another one of our CCE Master Gardeners, who's also a Master Naturalist. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Teresa.
We're so happy to have you share some of your expertise with our listeners. Let's dig in by starting with how you define garden pests. Is there an official New York State definition?
There is. The DEC has a definition. I'm going to paraphrase here. It's basically any organism that is non-native to the area and that has the potential for causing ecological, financial, or harm to people or animals. And I think it's one of those things that we're going to talk about pests today that are generally from Asia. And the difference between pests, generally, when we talk about invasive species, it's a species that comes from outside of the country, either kind of knowingly or unknowingly. And with plants, and we've talked about plants, invasive plants, generally they come because people have brought them intentionally through the nursery trade. With pests, it's generally something that's come here and it has been unintentional, like in crates, shipping crates, or in ships or things like that. So pests are very different. It's really important to talk about them, even though it can be kind of depressing, because it's good for people to be aware of what's here and what has the potential for coming here.
Okay, so in today's discussion, we're going to focus on three major destructive invasive pests, and it looks like they're all Asian. The Asian jumping worm, the emerald ash borer, and the spotted lantern fly. Let's dig in further and start with the worm, specifically the Asian jumping worm, also known as the crazy worm, the snake worm, Alabama jumpers. What are they?
Yeah, there's a lot of names for them. Well, it's basically an earthworm, and it's an earthworm from Asia, and they're super destructive because they're voracious eaters. They eat organic matter in the soil, and they basically change the composition of the soil. And we're getting lots and lots of calls about these. There's a lot more awareness about these pests because of all the damage they're doing.
Do they have natural predators, or just the whole ecology just adapted in Asia?
They have natural predators in Asia, but they don't here. And I mean, that's the whole thing with an invasive. They don't really have anything that eats them, or that, you know, any diseases or anything like that. So they basically can reproduce and thrive unchecked.
Okay, because we've always been taught if you have earthworms in your soil, that's wonderful.
Right. That's generally, we're talking about European earthworms when we say it's wonderful, because we don't really have a native earthworm. When the glaciers came through this area, they pretty much killed off all of the what we would call native earthworms. Earthworms that we think of like night crawlers are from Europe. When the colonists came over, when Europeans came over and they brought plants and soil, they brought over their own European worms. And that's kind of what we think of as our native worm.
Okay, so if we go out in the yard and we see a worm, how do we know what worm it is?
Well, that is a great question. There's a number of ways of knowing if you have Asian jumping worms. One, and I just actually did this in the fall. My sister lives in Syracuse, and she said, oh, I don't think I have them at all. And so in about 10 minutes, we realized that she did. There's a number of ways of knowing that. One is they leave what we call a soil signature. Basically, your soil starts looking very different if you have it. Asian jumping worms. So it looks very granular. It looks like almost like coffee grounds. So that's one way. And sometimes it actually pops out of the soil. I have them in my yard, and you actually see them in the lawn, even these kind of piles of the soil. And then the worms themselves act very differently, and they look very differently too.
Well, what damage do they cause other than the unsightly granular soil stuff?
Let me just talk a little bit about what they look like and how they act, since I probably should have talked a little bit more about that, because I think people are really trying to identify them, and then we can talk about the damage. The way you know that you have the worms, there's a couple of different ways when you actually see the worms. One is they're almost surface dwellers, so they're very, very shallow in the soil, whereas earthworms, your typical night crawlers, are further down. And a lot of times if you're digging, you'll find quite a number of them together. They seem to hang out together a lot. They also have incredibly kind of fast movement. They thrash a lot, and they are called snake worms because they actually move like snakes. They move very, very quickly, unlike regular earthworms. So you're going to have a fairly good idea if you see a worm and it's moving quickly that it's going to be that worm. Also, just their structure, they have a clatellum, kind of the stripe across them that kind of is smooth to the body. It's fairly easy to identify them when you have them. They move so quickly, and I'm going to gross you out here, Jean, that I've put them in pails, and they've actually climbed out of the pails. So, yeah, they're a creepy crawler, deep in the night kind of worms, yeah.
So they hang around in crowds. So if you're just scraping the top of your soil and they're there, you're going to know it right away.
You're going to know it. And if you see them, their movement. I mean, if you're even out weeding in the garden, they feel the vibrations of your body on the soil, and they'll come out of the soil. They'll emerge from the soil and move very quickly. So it's pretty easy to see them. Of course, if you have a worm and you don't know, you know, what it is, you can always bring it in to the master gardeners. They can identify it for you.
That's
too.
in the Hudson office.
Only the Hudson Only office.
Gene works in the ACRA office.
No, I mean, I've had lots and lots of people ask me if they had them on their property, and it's fairly easy from the soil signature and from looking at the worms.
So pretty much if you ask, you've probably already confirmed it.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the other thing is if you have them, you also are not going to see European earthworms. They generally push out the European earthworms. So if you've identified one, you probably don't have any other regular earthworms. You probably have a lot of them. They spread very, very rapidly.
So not only do you have the bad guys, they've pushed out the good guys.
That's essentially, so not only have they pushed out the good guys, but they've done a huge amount of damage. And you asked about that, so I can get back to that and answer that question for you. What they do is they're voracious eaters. They eat all of the organic material in the soil, and they basically excrete a huge amount of their poop, and their poop is full with nitrogen. So they change the composition of the soil. And what ends up happening is it really makes plants, trees, shrubs, perennials, it makes them much more vulnerable to disease. They even eat the roots of some plants. So they're really changing the composition of the soil. And also they're really pushing out some other kind of native creatures like spotted salamanders that do a lot of their living in leaf turf in the woods. You see a lot less of them. They're really actually having, I think, damage that we don't even know of yet.
So let's dig in a bit about their biology. Can you talk about their reproduction, eating habits, spread?
Yeah, here's the scary thing. They're big, big eaters. They're voracious eaters. And I think the thing that really has led to their spread very rapidly is they have multiple generations in one season. So they'll lay their eggs or cocoons, and the cocoons hatch generally in, you start seeing them in March or April. And then they usually have two and sometimes three generations of progeny. They do not need a male and a female, so they can asexually reproduce, and they also, they spread very, very rapidly too. So if you have them on your property, they can spread 13 acres in 1 year. So their biology is such that they're super competitive, like any invasive species, like any invasive plant species. They don't have any known predators, and they just are really, really rapid growers and rapid eaters.
Okay, now I read something about them that they make the soil hydrophobic. I love that word.
Yeah, in forests, they can make the soil such that, you know, drought is much more likely, and the plants cannot go through, you know, kind of big spells of drought and wet as easily. So yeah, they can really make the soil a totally, totally different composition than it was to begin with.
So water just runs off rather than being absorbed like it would be in leaf duff.
That's right. Okay. That's right. Exactly.
So how did the worms get here? And how are they spreading?
Yeah, I mean, they got here, as I was saying in the beginning, most of these pests have come here unintentionally, and most likely they came through packing materials or in crates or in mulch, and they can spread in a lot of different ways. And now that they're out there, and we've seen a lot of instances in Columbia and Greene counties, they can spread through if you're sharing plants. And one of the reasons why our group was one of the first groups in the state to stop their plant swaps, if you're giving somebody a plant and it has soil with it, you can have their cocoons in it so it can spread that way. You can have them spread through if you bring mulch or soil onto your property. Fishermen spread them if they're using them for bait and they drop them. A lot of people drop them, you know, when they're done fishing. So they're spreading pretty rapidly, and it's all about kind of knowledge and education, and we're trying to educate people about them in forums like this so that people understand that it's really easy to spread them. And if you don't have them, you know, you want to be really careful about not bringing, or at least thoughtful about not bringing, soil that you don't know about onto your property. Mulch, a lot of the mulch in the big box stores is from Asia, so you're going to, you know, have the potential of having them in that.
Is it labeled, the source?
Not generally. Ooh. No, not generally. I mean, you really want to know where it came from. So if you really want to bring mulch onto your property, I've talked to a lot of people who have, you know, had their own trees mulched or their neighbor's trees mulched or something like that. And if you do have them, you want to be really careful, you know, not to share plants with others. I would say even if you're going to go out hiking in a nice pristine site, you probably want to make sure that your boots are clean because you can carry the cocoons on your boots. I'm always careful if I go into any land conservancy site. It's because I have them on my property. I clean my boots off. I spray my boots off. If I take a shovel somewhere else, I'll clean off the shovel. So it's about, you know, good hygiene with your boots and your tools and things like that.
And machinery.
And machinery, yeah, absolutely. Machinery, you know, is the cause of spreading a lot of different invasive plants and invasive pests. Absolutely. So be clean, Gene.
All right. I'm a hermit anyway. Nobody comes on my property.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you just seal yourself up in your house, you're not going to have a problem with that.
My little, or better, I've sealed myself in with the worms.
There you go.
Well, what if you already have them in your garden? What should you do?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the $64,000 question. I don't think that anybody has come up with an absolute solution. I will tell you one of the things that I do in my really badly affected perennial gardens, especially ones in shade that are more damp, seem to have more of the worms. Or if you have a pond side where you're planting, it seems to have more worms. What I do in the fall, because I've lost, you know, whole areas of perennials from them because plants don't overwinter as well when you have them, I'll bring in some sterilized soil, some soil that I know is worm free, and just supplement the soil because some of the soil is just, you know, so degraded. I'll do that. There have been some folks who have had good luck with products or materials that have a chemical called saponin, which will kill the worms. So alfalfa pellets, people are using those. I mean, we're not necessarily saying that folks should use those, but certainly you can experiment with things like that. We're not advocating that. And there's a fertilizer, an organic fertilizer that has saponins in it as well, called Early Bird, that people are starting to try to use where they use on golf courses. But I think that positive news, if there is any positive news, is that there's a lot more awareness of them. when we first started seeing them a few years ago, I think a lot of people weren't even aware that they were on their property. There wasn't a lot of study. I think there's more scientific study because of the potential for damage of forests, the maple, sugar maple crops. There's a lot of potential for damage. And I think when people start seeing that dollars are at stake, I think there's going to be more research and hopefully some solutions coming down the road.
So the issue is you need to control the adults as well as the eggs, correct? So the adults don't overwinter.
The adults generally don't overwinter. That's true. And I know I have some colleagues who will go out in the spring and try to clean as many of them up as possible, you know, dispose of them. And that will, if you kill off, you know, a lot of that generation, you're going to have fewer worms coming in and having more babies.
And the way you can kill them is by solarizing them, or what's the best approach?
There's a lot of ugly ways to murder the worms, Teresa. What can I tell you?
Self-defense.
You can solarize them, but they become very stinky when you solarize them. I generally will put them in alcohol or something like that that will kill them immediately. Even though they are kind of hideous creatures, they didn't really ask to be here, and I hate to do things like that. So, you know, the most painless way possible, and the most painless way possible for you to, I just dump them in a bucket of rubbing alcohol generally, but you know, there's lots of different ways to kill them.
But then the real issue is the eggs that do overwinter.
Yeah, and I think the study that's going on is how do you get rid of those eggs? I mean, because that's the real issue. And I know that, you know, just anecdotally, when we have really harsh winters, a lot of times people report that they have fewer worms in that following season, but they do overwinter. I mean, that's the matter. You know, that's the real issue. So hopefully there'll be some, you know, there'll be some solutions coming down the road.
So is there research underway to help solve this or address this issue?
Yeah, there are some scientific studies going on. Yeah. I mean, but you know, in the Northeast, there's a lot of work being done in the Midwest because that's where they kind of first seem to have appeared. Michigan, Wisconsin, a lot of the states have really great websites too, if you're interested in kind of doing a little bit more research on it. There's a lot of information out there if you go out and Google it.
Well, I'm hearing as far as on the research, Vermont apparently has jumped in.
Yes.
And they're doing a lot of research.
Yes.
Now.
Yes, University of Vermont, that's
yeah.
Right.
And some of the earlier remedies, if you call them that, killed off the population of all the earth creatures. So don't be going out and looking for the stuff they use on the golf course, because you're going to do in your whole soil population. So
yeah, I mean, we're not really advocating for any solution right now that's tried and true, but you know, there's all kinds of people have talked about using dried mustard that irritates them. That has not worked for me. I really try to just supplement my soil as much as possible so that, and I don't put a lot of organic material on my soil because it basically just feeds them.
Thank you for listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson in Columbia County and Acre in Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. You can also email us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Today's topic is invasive pests, and we're joined by Tim Kennelty, a Master Gardener volunteer. Let's dig right back in. Now let's switch to the emerald ash borer. What is it?
At least they're pretty.
They are pretty. I mean, that's the thing. Some of these are pretty. The worms are not pretty at all. But the emerald ash borers, they have this beautiful, beautiful kind of green metallic coat. It's a beetle, again, from Asia, that is attacking all of our native ash species and really killing hundreds and thousands of trees.
How do you identify them?
This is one of the ones where I have them on my property. I have a lot of ash trees, and I have never actually seen the insect. The best way to identify them is to start seeing the damage in your trees, unfortunately. And that is kind of the first sign is if you have ash trees, and you know you identify pretty much all the ash species are affected by them. If you have ash trees and you start seeing a lot of woodpecker activity, that's one of the first signs. And then what happens is they lay their eggs on the ash tree, and the larva of their eggs will eat the cambium in the tree under the bark, and it essentially kills the tree. So what you'll start seeing damage on the tree. You'll start seeing bark strip off. You see kind of D-shaped holes, and then if you do see the bark peel off, you see on the trunk of the tree, you'll see like these S-shaped, almost like areas where the larva has kind of moved around and eaten. So it's usually you can identify the most by the damage and not by the actual insect themselves.
Yeah, when we cut firewood, it's very easy to identify an ash tree that's been affected because you do see all those tunnels that they make. So how did the emerald ash borer, the EAB, get here?
Yeah, they all got here from stupid people bringing them in some way. It's all human activity. And there's a theory, I've read a lot about this, and I don't think they're absolutely certain how they got here, but the first sightings really were in Michigan around Detroit. And so the thought is that they came through packing materials of automotive parts. There are even stories about, you know, the automotive workers working on the assembly line and seeing these beautiful insects flying around above. And so that's one of the ways they probably got into the country. And then they have spread, again, very rapidly. They can't fly themselves, but they've been transported. You talked about firewood, Teresa. That's really one of the main ways that they've been transported. When people cut down the wood and the eggs and larvae are then are transported, you know, long distances. That's how they've been moved around.
So you talk about the damage on the trunks and how clearly distinctive it is, and you know what did it. But by that point, isn't it kind of too late for that tree?
It is too late for that tree. Once a tree is infested, it's generally less than 5 years that it will die. And they can't fly a long distance, but if you have them on your property, they're generally going to fly from one tree to another. So kind of once you have them, you have them.
So both counties, Columbia and Greene, are infested pretty thoroughly, right?
They are. In fact, I think there's 30 counties in the state have them.
Just half.
I mean, it's, and they are certainly in both counties. You'll see damage in both counties. And there's ash tree is really a prevalent tree species in our area. So it's really killing a lot of trees.
It's supposed to be one of the best firewood woods.
Well, there you go. That's why people transport it. There's our problem in a nutshell. So if you have them, there's a couple of things you can do. One is if you have one big major tree that you want to save and it hasn't been infested, arborists can do an injection of an insecticide that will keep that particular pest at bay. It's very expensive. And I mean, I have hundreds of ash trees, so I'm not going to use that as a solution. The other thing I always suggest is planting other species, because if you're going to have those trees die on your property, plant some different tree species. One of the main problems with having them on your property is safety issues. And I went and talked to one of the towns here because they got very worried because they had trees falling down. So if you have them kind of in the path of, you know, your kids or your pets, or if you're walking around, you might want to take that tree down if you think that it's infested. Otherwise, they're there. So I would leave them up.
Yeah, many municipalities are actually doing tree inventories to identify the ash trees and make sure they proactively take them down if they're infected.
Yeah, I mean, it's becoming like all of these pests. It's becoming, you know, not just a biological disaster, but also it's financially, it's causing huge, huge impact as far as, you know, people spending money on these things.
So aside from making sure you don't move firewood around, are there other things you can do to prevent this?
One thing that is happening, and there are some organizations doing this, I think the DEC is doing this, they're trying to identify stands of resistant ash trees. And I know there's some programs, I can't tell you off the top of my head what they are, but if you do have, you know, ash on your property and you see that you have some infestations, but there are trees that aren't infested, you may want to look into that, because they're really looking to breed resistant trees. And there are stands of trees that are just completely untouched. They're rare. I think it's like 95% of the trees are actually, once they're infested, are killed. But they're just like anything else, just like any other disease, there are resistant trees.
Teresa, we do have some links for the Emerald Ash Borer information on our website.
They're on the website, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so if you need to know more.
Yeah, and there's a huge amount of information out there on this topic, too, because it's one that, you know, it's a species that is, you know, fairly well established in our area. So there's been a lot of literature out there. So if you're interested, not only our links, but, you know, just Google it and you're going to find a lot of information.
So the one good thing about the Emerald Ash Borer is we have a wonderful woodpecker population now.
You try to find the silver lining for these things, or hopefully people just start planting more trees on their properties, you know, because they certainly suck up all the carbon in the air. And they, if you want to have kind of a nice ecology on your property, you probably do want to plant new trees if you think you have it.
Thank you for listening to Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, with offices in Hudson and Columbia County and Acre and Greene County. You can learn more about the Cooperative Extension by visiting the website at ccecolumbiagreene.org. Today's topic is invasive pests, and we're joined by Tim Kennelty, a Master Gardener volunteer. Let's dig right back in. So another relative newcomer to the Northeast is the spotted lanternfly. What is this?
So, Teresa, your listeners are probably getting really depressed now, and I don't want to feel like Dr. Doom here, but this there's a little bit of a positive spin to this one. This is an insect pest that has the potential to be really, really destructive. The good news is, unlike the worms and unlike the emerald ash borer, it's not quite here yet in our area. So that's the really good news. And that's why it's really good for people to have awareness of these pests. It's essentially an insect pest from Asia again. It's again, Jean's favorite kind of very, it's kind of a very attractive, if you know, objectively, almost looks like a moth. It's got red wings and black and white wings and kind of a yellow abdomen. And the issue with this is it has sucking parts, both the adult and the larva have sucking parts on their body that, and they suck the sap out of trees and basically make trees very, very vulnerable to disease and to other pests.
So this is another very pretty moth.
It is a pretty moth. It is. What else can I say? There's some pretty moths out there that are nasty too.
A bunch of us went to a Master Gardener conference in Pennsylvania, and we heard a lot about the spotted lanternfly there. How did it actually get to the United States?
Yeah, I don't know. This is like all of these pests. I don't know if anybody knows exactly how it came here, but the first sightings were in Pennsylvania in 2014. So fairly recent, and it spread to some of the other mid-Atlantic states. They found some dead species of this in New York State, but it hasn't quite gotten here yet.
Well, the awareness is phenomenal compared to a lot of the other things. People spotted it right away. The fact that it's pretty attracts attention. And our phones are getting calls from truck drivers who are reporting, fortunately, from considerable distance. They're on the Pennsylvania border, but people are aware. And if truck drivers are aware and reporting, then the awareness across the board is pretty phenomenal. And that's pretty...
I think the awareness is there because of the potential for the destruction of this, the destructiveness of this species too, because its host plant is the tree of heaven, which again is an invasive species from Asia, but it is known to attack a lot of different commercial horticultural crops like grapes and fruit trees and walnut trees. So there is the potential for huge financial damage and, you know, money talks. So I think that's one of the reasons why there is so much awareness. And one of the reasons I think truck drivers are reporting it is because it can't fly very far either. And it's hitchhiking on vehicles and that's how it's moving around. Mm-hmm. So they can lay its eggs on cars, on trucks. And that's really the way it's being transported again by humans.
It's hard to spot the eggs, though, right? They kind of blend in, it seems.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where you're not going to be going out to your car and looking for spotted lanternfly eggs unless you really don't have a lot to do in your life, probably. Really, the best thing to do, if you're driving from one of these states, you probably want to put your car through a car wash. That's probably the best thing you can do to prevent these from moving around.
Yeah, Pennsylvania is very aggressively encouraging this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of good news about the bad news.
Yeah.
Now, the different life phases have different host plants too, correct? Now, it's the larval stage that eats the ailanthus, the
right.
tree of heaven,
right.
which is a weed tree. So that's a kind of a wash, like, okay, maybe you get rid of
all
of them.
But we do have a lot of ailanthus, and they're really hard to control. So they're around
yeah.
in both counties.
So you've got a weed feeding on another
that's
invasive.
Right. That's right.
And that's a double whammy. And then at the adult stage is where they will eat the farm crops.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that's
they've
right.
got a vast...
I mean, so one thing you can do besides, you know, washing your car regularly is if you do think that you have ailanthus on your property, and it's fairly easy to identify, you can try to, you know, really limit that. I mean, I found some sprouts and, you know, the best way to do that is to cut them back. And if you are so inclined, you can paint them with like glyphosate or something like that. But that is something you really want to make sure that you don't have big stands of ailanthus on your property.
So that's a host that you're more than... welcome to get rid of.
It's a bad invasive tree species anyway, so it's not like you're doing any damage to the environment or
okay,
something.
Okay, and
like
we
that.
Do have, I know our website has information on those.
Yep.
So if you don't know what an ailanthus is, then you might want to
They're actually
check
kind of
in.
They're kind of pretty
oh, they're
too,
very
Jean.
Pretty. They
so
call
there
them tree
you go.
Of heaven.
Yeah, they're kind of pretty too. So there's
bad
some pretty
guys.
Nasty things out there.
And reporting the presence, if God forbid you should find one.
Well, one of the things you're going to see is, again, like the emerald ash borer, you're not necessarily going to see the insect. You're going to see the damage because what they do is when they suck the sap of the tree, they leave this really sticky residue. And so you'll see the stickiness on the tree. You'll see actually mold attracted to the stickiness too. So you're probably going to see that first. And in fact, I've heard or read about people in Pennsylvania, it's so sticky that you walk outside and you get it on your clothes and you get it in your hair. It's just like really pervasive. So that's probably what you would see first. If you have fruit trees in your yard or something like that and you see stickiness on the bark, you probably want to take a look at that a little bit further. You may want to report that. You take a picture of it and send it to us. But more, if you really think you have the infestation, I would report it to the DEC if it's in Greene or Columbia County, because they really are wanting to keep this out. Or the PRISM, your Partnership for Regional Invasive Species Management. Yes, I always forget the acronym, but yeah, you want to report if you really see one or if you see damage that you think is attributed to that species.
And there are a lot of places now where you can do reporting of pests. So you could look on our website or just Google whatever it is you think you're looking at, and there will probably be a place you can report to.
I mean, there's things like IMAP invasives that you can report, but I would think with something like spotted lanternfly, which isn't prevalent in our counties, and we're really looking to keep it out, if you see something and you're really pretty sure that that's what it is, I would send a note to DEC or call DEC, because they really want to know. They're really trying to contain the species.
That'd be the fastest response. They're motivated right now.
Yeah, and again, all of this stuff, it can be depressing, but it's really about, especially if you feel like you want to be a steward of your land and, you know, good for the environment, you just want to be aware of all of this.
Okay, my favorite question. What's your favorite pest?
Of course, you always surprise me with things like this. I would say Eugene, but...
Thank you.
I hate the worms more than almost anything. Yeah. I hate the worms because I have them, and it really, when I first realized that I had them on my property, it was pretty depressing, but I've managed to garden with them. My favorite or most unfavorite plant invasive is Japanese stiltgrass, and guess what? Generally, when you have Japanese stiltgrass, you find the worms in the same place. They have some kind of symbiotic relationship. When you see them both, you need to go out and have a big stiff martini after that, I'd say.
Okay.
Tim, it's been a pleasure having you with us today. I suspect we're going to have you more since we've only just scratched the surface on the
Hopefully
topic
on some
pests.
Positive topic, Teresa, next time.
Butterflies.
We'd also like to thank WGXC 90.7 Radio for hosting this program, as well as production support from Donna Peterson and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this edition of Digging In with Master Gardeners, a program of Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties. You can learn more about Cornell Cooperative Extension by visiting our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org, and you can contact us by emailing us at colgremg@cornell.edu. Master Gardeners are typically available on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays in the Hudson office, or on Tuesday and Thursday mornings in the ACRA office. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, inch by inch, row by row, let us help your garden grow.
You can contact Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties with questions at ccecolumbiagreen.org, visit us in Hudson or in ACRA, or ask us questions on the Master Gardeners of CCE Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook group. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal program and employment opportunities. Someone warm them from below till the rains come.